for you.
I got the alcoholism.
Doesn't it suck?
Hey, good evening, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, David.
For those who care to join us, let's have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer.
God. Grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. And I'm going to do it because I'll pretend like I'll remember to do it later, and then I'll be the one who forgets. Okay. We did that. Okay. Also, we respectfully ask those present to please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we recognize that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we're discussing step 4, part 2. Last week, we talked about resentments. So this week, we're going to do fear and sex. Snicker, giggle, giggle, snicker. That's good. Let's see. So if you would, please help us welcome our panel. We have Amy and Glenn.
Welcome to the team.
So I will read the step and the first paragraph, and then if you haven't been here before, it's essentially a speaker meeting. Our panelists will share their experience, strength, and hope on the material. So step 4, part 2. Step 4 reads, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We're going to start off tonight on page 67. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and his wife. This short word somehow touches every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Ladies first.
Okay. My name is Amy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Amy.
And in general, how fear touches every aspect of my life, really, it's the thing that's beneath all my resentments, and it's the thing that's beneath all my self-seeking. It's the thing that that makes me restless, irritable, and discontent. Wherever I am, I want to be somewhere else because I'm sure that where I am is not good enough. however I look, whatever I'm wearing, it would be better if. I'm afraid that you won't love me unless I say the right thing or look the right way. And if you don't love me because I don't know who God made me to be, then I'm screwed. That's the key to the future and the fourth step, that I allow the world and its people to dominate me because I don't know who I am outside of being self-seeking, outside of looking to you to tell me who I am and what I'm worth. And these fears are based on that false system of belief. One of my false systems of belief is good AAs always have a home group and are active in it. Good AAs always have a sponsor and do everything their sponsor says. Good AAs don't rock the boat. Blah, 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 blah. Now, I may have the greatest sobriety on the face of the earth, but because I have this system of belief that if I don't follow the rules, I'm not going to be okay, that does, in fact, make me not be okay. So that's how fear affects me in a general way. How fear affects me in a specific way is I wake up in the morning and I forgot to set my alarm and I notice that it's 5 minutes later than I should have gotten up. So I'm laying in the bed. I'm 5 minutes later than I should have been. I'm thinking, if I get up right now and I go straight to work, I'll get in the office, I'll probably be on time and it won't make a big deal. But then the next thought is, but then I won't be able to iron my clothes. And if I go to work and my clothes aren't ironed, some son of a gun's going to have something to say about me, about how I don't look right. So maybe I'll just not wear the clothes that I thought I was going to wear, and I'm going to figure out another outfit. But that's not the outfit I'm going to wear today because I really wanted to wear this. Then it goes on and on and on. And now it's 10 minutes past, and I'm still laying in the bed, and I'm still thinking. And finally, at about 12 minutes past, I think, screw my boss, screw the work, I'm quitting. I'm quitting. I was going to get fired anyway. I'm quitting. And it's 12 minutes past. Works like a mile down the road. But I have absolutely played out this story based on my false system of belief. My false system of belief that is a good employee is always there 30 minutes early. Because I've got control issues. I got to be the first person anywhere. I got to have the best seat. I got to watch everybody coming in. Got to get the lay of the land so I can, you know, be in charge. How fear also affects me is with a crippling self-consciousness. I can barely open my mouth and speak to you. I'm not struggling with this, obviously, at this point. But there was a time when I could barely open my mouth and speak to you because I had to be formulating and figuring what's the right thing to say. I just recently had a conversation with somebody about going to AA meetings where there's a competitive spirit in the room. And it seems like everyone is doing their level best to sell this thing. And everyone is doing their level best to, like, circle like sharks around the newcomer and save them. As if I or anyone else speaks for their higher power. Or who can quote the lines of the big book the quickest and the most accurately, as if the words have anything to do with living the spirit of the thing. But so that kind of fear that I judge myself by what everybody else is doing, even if I think the rest of you are full of bull, I'm still judging myself based on what everybody else is doing. That kind of fear paralyzes me. It cripples me. There's a saying that most people build castles in the air, but only alcoholics take their luggage and actually move in. This last line says that we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. And what that means is, what it means for me is that I'm stealing away the moments and the hours that God gave me to live effectively and serenely because I'm up here. And I'm living a life up here that has very little to do with what's going on around me out here. And that fear is underneath everything. Every time I'm angry with you because of the way you behaved, I don't like how you behaved, it's mainly because you didn't treat me the way I feel like I need to be treated. Every time I'm mad at someone, we ran out of gas on the way over here. And for a split second, I was angry at my man because he has a heart condition and it was going to be me that had to get out and walk to go get gas. And so just as I was tuning myself up to this reality of being mad at him, what I realized was it's my flipping car, and I'm the one that's been driving around for 2 days with the light flashing. But because I know more than the manufacturer of the car, I never bothered to stop and get gas because I knew I wasn't going to run out. But what's really underneath that is I'm mad at him that I have to do the walking. But what's really going on is I'm afraid people are going to see me walking down the side of the road, sweating myself to death, and they're going to think, what a loser. She's a loser. Why's she walking down the side of the road with a gas can in her hand? So this fear is a very serious thing. I mean, it doesn't sound like a big deal, but it really is a life and death thing when I consider that this is robbing me of the time that I have been given. When I look at my life in terms of the fact that I'm a child of God, I belong to God, that means when somebody says to me, how are you doing? How's your day been? I always say, it's a great day, because it wasn't my day, it was God's day. And fear just craps all over that. That's all I have to say.
Thanks, Amy.
My name is Glenn Mifflin. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 16th, 1995, and I have a home group, Big Book, in Ghent. It's on Tuesday night at 5:30 at Christ in St. Luke's. It just really fascinated me that David asked me to do this part of the fourth step, because fear is one of those things that is a constant in my life. I never thought that I had a fear of anything when I was drinking, because I lived in a fantasy world. I'd built this world up around me so that I didn't have to deal with fear. And it worked for quite a long time. But when I got sober, you know, fear hit home. And in this fourth step, I'm in a process of trying to find out who I am. The truth about me, and that's what this is for, is to find out the truth about Glenn. And the reality is that I have one basic fear that I've been running from my whole freaking life, and that's and I've just, you know, I've realized that more recently than any other time. But the reality is that my own mortality is something that's scaring me to death. And I've, like I said, I built that fantasy world so I didn't have to encounter that fear. But everything I do is based on not acknowledging that fear. And even sober, I will act out so that I don't have to deal with that fear about my own mortality. I mean, when I think about it, me not existing is something I cannot fathom. And that's hard. That's really hard. So rather than accept it and get on with life, I'll avoid it and I'll do things to not see it. And that's what I did. You know, that's what I did while I was drinking. I didn't have to think about it. Before I turned 14, I thought about it a lot because I encountered that particular item when I was 3 years old as a child. So it was constant in my life. And then after 14, when I started drinking, I didn't have to see it anymore. It was gone. And that's what alcohol did for me. And like I said, when I got sober, it came crashing home. So the reality is that I had to go through this process to find out who I was and what it was that I was building up to avoid. And I did get to that point. I didn't get to it initially, but through the process of all these inventories that we're allowed to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got that point, and I found out who I am, and I'm getting better at being okay with me being afraid. It doesn't stop me today like it did before. You know, I'm able to live my life in a bit of joy and happiness today instead of in a constant state of running from something, constantly avoiding something. So it's really nice to have, you know, this way of life to nail down what it is that I am, and then go through the process of accepting that fact. It's no different than accepting that I'm an alcoholic. You know, when I get to the point of accepting that, then I got a lot of other things to accept about me. And when I get okay with those things, then I start getting okay with the world and the people in it. But until then, I'm in a constant struggle trying to, you know, get right, trying to avoid stepping on people's toes, doing this, that, and the other, and then having to make all that stuff right. So this whole process is an entirely necessary thing for every one of us to go through in order to get to that point where we can pass that the stuff on that we've gone through and what we've learned. And I also like to say that this front row being empty is really kind of nice. Everybody followed instructions and stayed away from the front row. Thanks.
All right, we're going to continue on page 68. Perhaps there's a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have it and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think the spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. Amy?
The way that I take this step out of this part of the big book is I do my resentments, and underneath each resentment, I look for the self-centered fear. So, you know, if I'm mad at my home group because they don't blow smoke up my butt all the time, what I really am is I'm in the self-centered fear that I'm afraid I'm not that great of an AA. So I take all those self-centered fears that are underneath those resentments, and I start breaking them down. You know, I start crossing them out as they start repeating. And although at the beginning it may look like I'm afraid I'm not that great of an AA, I'm afraid I'm not a good enough sponsor, I'm afraid I'm, you know, not a very good daughter, I'm afraid I'm unemployable, it starts breaking down to I'm not worthy. I don't deserve to be treated any better than this. And when I get to that place where I see that most of my self-centered fears have broken down into my deep sense of unworthiness based on everything I think I know about the world, which is really not what I know, but just what I think I know, I see that if I am that deeply unworthy, then there is no God for me. If I am unworthy to be treated any better by you or by circumstances or whatever, then I am unworthy for there to be a power greater than myself who loves me and accepts me and would claim to be my creator. And in a world where there is no God, it means life has to be on my own power. And I've taken the steps enough to know that no human power can relieve my alcoholism. So if I've broken down these fears to I'm not worthy of having a God, and I am faced with having to live out the rest of my life on my own power, well, I'm screwed, because I know self-reliance always fails. No matter how much, when things start to go wrong, I start to impose my will a little harder. You know, then I'm throwing my self-will on it. I'm punching it into position. I'm getting it in there. And then I can't even enjoy it once I've gotten it into the place that I want it to be, because now I got to bust my butt to keep it there, because it's going to fall apart at any moment, because it wasn't supposed to be there to begin with. But in that position, where I'm definitely not living out that step three decision, this is definitely not living out he is the director, I'm the actor. I mean, I've already gone through this. I haven't been able to direct my life in such a way that it's manageable, that I have any serenity. I have not been able to parent myself. He's the father, I'm the child. I haven't been able to provide for my own needs. I need a parent. He's the principal, I'm the agent. I'm not able to be self-directed. I have no self-discipline whatsoever. If you tell me to do something, that's the last thing I'm going to do. So so if I'm coming up in all of this fear, I'm not living out that decision that I made in step three. And taking a look at this, just like Glenn said, it doesn't relieve my fear. It doesn't make my fear go away entirely. But what it does is it gives me access to a power that helps me to act beyond my fear. I have it written somewhere on one of these pages that that action plus God equals the miracle. And that has been my experience over and over again, that no matter how afraid I am, no matter how paralyzed I am with that self-consciousness and that self-centeredness, and I'm absolutely sure that you're all watching me and listening to me. On Saturday night, I was talking to somebody upstairs at Cornerstone, and we had to walk down the stairs, and I know I sounded like a herd of buffalo coming down those steps. I'm sure the whole meeting was disrupted. But you know what? When I walked in the room, nobody looked up at me. No one was paying any attention. So this self-centeredness, this self-consciousness that in my sick, distorted perception of things means that I'm taking care of myself and getting my needs met, really the reverse is true. I'm shutting down any possibility for joy. I'm shutting down any possibility for forward movement because I'm just stuck. And where I am stuck is in that place of I am unworthy of having a God. And really, when I peel off the substances and the behaviors that are part of the pathology of addiction, what I'm left with, this is a disease of self-reliance versus God-reliance. Am I going to live self-reliant, where I'm dominated by my emotional nature, where I'm prey to misery and depression, where I think if it is to be, it is up to me, and I'm always failing over and over and over again? Or am I going to live God-reliant, where I have faith that all is in divine order, where I have faith that no matter what I'm looking at, I recognize I don't know what I'm looking at? Because the truth is, the bad stuff is the good stuff. It's all the good stuff. I really can't afford to live any other way. Either God is everything or God is nothing. It's not a kind of pick and choose whatever, whatever, whatever. So if I'm looking at you and judging you to be less than what you should be in order for me to be happy, or I'm judging me to be less than what I should be in order for me to be happy, what I'm doing is affirming at a deep level inside, God doesn't know what he's doing. God made a mistake with that person. Oh, God's asleep at the switch. Look what just happened. I can't live that way. Because if I'm living that way, I am doomed to this. Fear. All over the place. How it sets things in motion, you know, how I set the ball in motion and get into other people's stuff is that I absolutely believe that I have to be of service. So I'm so busy trying to be of service that what I'm actually doing is poaching on other people's boundaries, kind of foisting myself on them, taking up too much space in their lives, doing things for them that they could be doing for themselves. And mainly, I'm making a decision that I know what you need to be okay. Not what you think you need to be okay, but I've decided I know what you need to be okay. So I'm imposing that on you. Now, what's going to happen? I don't know how it is that I get surprised when people are like slapping me off and not answering the telephone anymore. It's because I've stepped on your toes. And then that puts me in a fearful place because I'm an all or nothing thinker. And I'm like, forget it. I'm not helping anybody anymore. Forget it. I'm not going back to that meeting. Let them rot. As if that would make a difference. But that's how fear sets me up to get in trouble. You know, I'm manufacturing misery. I'm making stuff. I'm making up stories in my head. And then I am acting out in the material realm as if the story I made up is actually true. And it's not. It's almost never true. Even though I think I'm the smartest person in the entire world, and I can read you like a book, and I know exactly what's going on, I have no idea. Thanks.
Thanks, Amy. When I took the third step, I can tell you right now that I had no clue what was a higher power for me. Thank goodness I was told that if I took action after taking the third step, then this higher power would present itself to me. because I couldn't have, you know, it talks about throwing away our old ideas and starting over. That's what I had to do. I had to get rid of all that old stuff and start over. So I had to find a new higher power. I couldn't have the higher power that I supposedly had as a child. So I had to go ahead and move forward into the fourth step and start finding out who I was. And little did I know that by taking that action, I was being given that courage to take that action, even though I was afraid, by this higher power that I had no clue about. That's the way it worked. Through going through the steps and going through the process of inventory and finishing out on the rest of it, I've had that higher power expose itself to me. I've had spiritual awakenings throughout this whole thing, but I finally had that spiritual experience that people talk about. And it took a while for it to come about. That's why it's real important that I pass this along to people, that I didn't get it instantly. I didn't get a higher power that I was comfortable with right away. It took a long time. It took a lot of experiences built on top of each other to understand that I had a higher power and that I can have faith in that power. So if you're struggling with this, just don't give up. You know, stick with it. It will happen if you stay. It will happen if you do the stuff and follow through. I mean, that's a guarantee. It happened for me. And if it can happen for me, it can happen for anybody. But back to the fear and the fact that, you know, when I went and asked for help with this fear, I got the help that I needed for the fear to be taken down to a point so I could actually function in this world. That's the key. I can throw myself at it all I want, all the willpower that I have and all of everything else. But until I ask for it to be taken away, it won't go away. And when I asked for it to be taken away, it got to a point where I could manage, in my life the way it was. Even with the fear, I could function. And today, I was going through a lot of fear, not necessarily all about this being up here, but some of it was this. But I kept asking every time it popped into my head for it to be removed. Kept asking, and finally, I calmed down a little bit and started functioning properly, through the day. But I don't get the opportunity to throw my life or throw my will against it anymore. I just can't do that. I mean, I can, given the chance. I can frustrate myself if I want to. If I want to have any kind of success, I have to ask for that, whatever that fear is, to be removed. And if I follow through with that, then I get the opportunity to move forward in the day, in the week, in my life. Thanks.
All right. We're going to continue on page 68 now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is the lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiters of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them?
I have been sponsored through this part of inventory, started not doing this just on relationships where there was sexual or romantic activity, but all significant relationships, starting with the relationship with my father and my brothers, and bringing it up to the present, so that I could get a look at, again, that false system of belief that kind of dictates my attitudes and my behaviors. And what I found out was that I'm a user, and I really always felt that men were to provide security. In my home, my mom did all of the emoting. My father went out and brought home a paycheck so we could live our lives, and that was kind of it. And I really always treated men that way. They were either an ATM or, you know, a sex machine. And I could not see any use in messing with them other than that. And that certainly falls in the category of inconsiderate. And how that relates to fear for me is that I had a system of belief that I need to have someone who earns a living to take care of me, because I'm not capable of taking care of myself. And it also means that I feel like I am not enough on my own. I need to have an appendage as proof to the world that I am viable, that I'm sexually viable, that I'm desirable, that I'm worth something. But when I got past those early relationships and into the sexual romantic stuff, what I saw, and I mean, I hadn't really ever noticed this before, but what I saw was that I had sex on the first date. Always had sex on the first date, because I could not stand the vulnerability of the getting to know you period. And for me, let's get on and get in it, because to me that seals the deal. That's kind of good lubrication for whatever conversation you're going to have. It just makes everything more juicy, and you can kind of ignore all the other stuff or push it to the side, because, you know, if the action's good, who cares? But really, it was my fear of taking a look at, do I really like this person, which I never took a look at that, because I was always much more about, do they like me? Again, my deep sense of unworthiness put me in a position where I was willing to accept crumbs. I couldn't understand why it was that I went through, you know, 500 Mr. Worthlesses in a row, but it was because I was willing to accept crumbs. It was because I put myself in one position after another where what I was attracted to and what I was attracting was certainly much less than what God made me for, certainly much less than what God made sex for. But this deep fear of my unworthiness, and then as I got older and the clock is ticking and I'm thinking I want to be like all the normal girls or the real girls, and I need to have a husband and I need to have children and I got to make it happen. I got to get in there and make it happen. So again, third step out the window, because I'm in charge. And it's not ever working out for me. And the truth is that God did not make me to be a mother, and God did not make me to be someone's wife. That's just, it's not who I am. But I tried to make that happen because I had this false system of belief that that's what everybody else does. You know, everybody else kind of has this normal, reasonably straight line. They go to school, they go to college, or maybe they don't. They get a career, they get married, they have babies, and then their babies grow up and they do the exact same thing. Now, I don't actually know that that's what everybody does, but I think that's what everybody does. That's kind of what it looks like everybody does. And these attitudes, this way of thinking is really lazy thinking. You know, everybody, I'm always saying I'm an alcoholic, I have black or white thinking. Really, that dualism is just laziness. It's a lack of really taking a look at things. Because I think I said last week, I don't know where I got all that stuff from. I think that I read Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret too many times. Or I spent too many afternoons watching the Brady Bunch or whatever. And I believed all this stuff. But I'm setting up this system of belief by which I'm going to judge my life and judge everybody else's life, and it's based on fiction. That stuff is all fiction. But I have internalized it to such an extent that I think that's what I have to do. That's what everyone has to do in order to be okay. So I've put this incredible pressure on myself. And what it means is that, you know, well, as an alcoholic, I'm not really in for the long game ever. I'm always in for the short-term gratification. Let's get it done, move on to the next episode. So I would plot out who looked good, who looked right, and then I'd go get them. And then I'd sleep with them on the first date. They'd move in with me 2 weeks later. And then I'd spend years trying to figure out how to get rid of them, how to and how to stay away from them. Because I can't blame them. It was me. Again, what showed up for me was lack of power is my dilemma. Because I'm thinking, this guy is worthless. This is going nowhere. This is ruining my life. My friends and family are asking me, what are you doing? This is no good. I know this is no good, but lack of power is my dilemma. I can't stay away from them. And I can't stay away from them because I've formed a habit. I'm maladjusted to life. I've fallen into the addictive pattern again, but also because I'm afraid. I'm afraid of being different than everyone else. I'm afraid if I don't do exactly what you do, I'll be kicked out of the club. I'll be out on the edge of the universe by myself, unloved and unlovable. That's how dramatic I am when I'm talking to myself. And it's just not the case, because really, if I took 5 minutes to get to know you, instead of judging my insides by your outsides, I would probably think, no, that's not for me. That may be working out for them, but I don't really want that for myself. But I don't do that, because I make these snap judgments. I default into seeing the world through a filter of self, self-centeredness, self-pity, and self-seeking. And it puts me in a position. You know, there's that saying, if you don't want to get screwed, don't assume the position. Well, I kept assuming it over and over and over again. My problems were of my own making. You know, I had the exact same problems getting into my 30s with you know, my serial sports screwing as I had with my father and my brothers, because I was looking to men to satisfy the role that I had assigned them. I was playing God. I had assigned myself a role. This is what the female does. And I had assigned you a role. This is what the male does. And that's what we're going to do. Lazy thinking based on a false system of belief. And fear is just all over, up and down, all over it. And I'm standing firmly in the way of God's perfect will unfolding in my life. Of course, things never worked out, because it was always based on my will, based on my screwed up thinking. So I was actually forming relationships that were lies based on lies based on lies. And all those lies were a result of my self-centered fears that I'm not worthy of any better. All of you are doing it perfectly. You're all on your way rejoicing, having great sex, plenty of money, never any worries, and I'm the screw up. So I got to work as hard as I possibly can to catch up and be exactly the same as you. That's all.
Thanks, Amy. When I was a kid, I didn't have relationships modeled in my family. My dad came home, he didn't talk. My mom took care of the house, she didn't talk. And we sat at the table for dinner, and you were not allowed to talk. So I didn't realize that a relationship had a conversation in it. I just thought you just existed. So when I started drinking, it was before I had actually gotten into an intimate relationship with anybody else at 14. So all I did was make it up on the fly from that point on. So I really didn't have a clue on how to be in a relationship, one way or the other. Intimate, friendship, anything. I didn't have a clue. I every time I'd get scared, I'd insert myself more, and I'd push more, and all that did was push people away. And it's just amazing at how that worked, and I just kept doing it, and never got an understanding that that was the wrong way to pursue it. And I tell you what, I told you what the big fear in my life. There's a number two fear that's right up there. It's very close, and that's abandonment, people leaving. And I will do everything I can to hold on to somebody, short of you know, lock them in a closet. But I do everything I can. I will turn into whatever you think I need, you know, whatever you think you need in order for you to stay. And I did that with a girlfriend for 10 years, and then I got out of that relationship and into a marriage right within about 5-6 months. And I stayed in that marriage for 29 years. And I did everything I could to avoid the truth about that. I ignored stuff that was going on. I threw money at it. I did everything I could for her not to go away. And you know what? She went away anyway. She left anyway. And there was nothing I could do to stop that. I mean, so the reality is that everything I did for all this time in my life was for naught. So I got sober, and I'm supposed to be learning how to do things, how to be a part of life, how to be a part of society, whatever. And I still don't have a clue on how to be in a relationship. I can tell you the first really successful relationship that I've had is with my two sponsors, well, three sponsors. And I have one of my sponsors as a friend that's one of my closest friends that I have right now. But he's not sponsoring me anymore. That's why he's my friend. Any of you that have been through a sponsor will understand that. But my sponsor I have currently is probably the most successful relationship that I've had in my life. And the only reason that is the case is because he knows how to do it. It's not because of me. I can guarantee you, because I'm very sensitive, and if he says the wrong thing, I won't talk to him for a while. And he knows this of me, and he'll leave me alone. And then when I come back, he'll say, well, I was wondering how long it was going to take this time. And then I'll go through the process and tell him what it was and, you know, what do I need to do. And he said, well, cut the time down this time, the next time, between when you stop talking to me and start again. And I've slowly started cutting that time down. You know, I'll get upset, and it's usually not more than a day or two now. So it's getting better. It's getting better. I'm learning how to communicate slowly but surely. But intimate relationships, I'm still having a very, very difficult time with, because I think that I need to try very hard. And the reality is that I just need to be there and not try, just to be me. Because when I'm trying, I'm not being me. I can't seem to get that through my head, though, because I keep trying real hard. And I prayed today because I'm having a little bit of a problem with somebody I'm dating right now, and it seems that I keep pushing and pushing again. And I can see this, and I'm trying not to do that. I'm trying very hard not to do that. So I prayed today about it. And I'm hoping that I'm going to back off a little bit and not be that push that I've been doing here lately. But it's all working through it and having experiences. I hope not to give up on this. You know, I hope to keep going through this and doing the things that the program tells me to do. Because I'm even though I'm an introvert, even though I don't like to be around a whole lot of people a lot of times, I do have to be around you some. I do have to have you in my life. That's a fact. If I don't, then I don't get to practice this way of life the way it should be practiced. So I got to keep that in mind. And when fear starts pushing me away and you away, I've got to ask for help to stop that. Thanks.
Thanks, Glenn. I'm going to mash up a couple of paragraphs here because we're short. We're going to continue on page 69. We reviewed our conduct over years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. Amy?
I didn't say that my home group is also Big Book in Ghent on Tuesday nights. Good place to come. And my sobriety date is May 9th, 1994. What I discovered after taking this inventory was that, A, I really had no idea what I was doing in relationships. And a lot of the reason that I had no idea what I was doing in relationships is because I didn't know who I was. You know, I was pretending to be something that you would like so you would stay with me and I wouldn't be alone. I wouldn't be rejected. I wouldn't be abandoned. So, you know, I was either swinging from the chandeliers and doing all kinds of tricks so you would think that I was earthy and body and, you know, some sexual goddess, or I was acting virginal and a little repressed so you would think that I was a lady. You know, I would do whatever worked. As with everything else, just playing a role. Now, it's not possible to have a healthy relationship when I'm playing a role because I'm never giving you the opportunity to find out who I really am. So the way that you're interacting with me is never going to be appropriate, even though I'm going to keep getting angry that you're not treating me as well as I should be treated. One, it's because I don't think I deserve any better, but two, I've never given enough of myself to you so that you know how to treat me appropriately. So I found out I really have absolutely no idea what I'm doing. I found out that I'm selfish and self-centered in my relationships just as I am with everything else. And when I first started coming around, I heard somebody talk about this, and they said, remember that you are never the most important part of the relationship. And I went for years thinking that that meant that the other person was the most important part of the relationship. And that may be true, that I am supposed to be of service and to see what I have to contribute to you. But what I really believe that means today is that my higher power has to be present. I don't believe now, then, or any time in the future that I'm ever going to be capable of managing a relationship in a healthy, loving, open way without a higher power in the mix. I just don't think it's possible, because not only am I filled with the disease and delusions of the mind and can get off track with obsessions and who knows what kind of craziness, it's always possible that my partner is doing the same thing as well. The only person that I did not sleep with on the first date is the partner I have now. And interestingly, we dated for months, for like 3 months. And I finally just said, look, this is too much talking for me. Take off your clothes. Let's go. Because I can't take this anymore. This is just too much for me to worry about. It's just too much for me to handle. There's the bed. Let's roll. I don't want to think about it anymore. And truly, it was too much talking for me. I don't think I had ever talked to a man as much as I talked to this man. And it was really, it was a little too much exposure for me. You know, I'll take my clothes off and walk around the room. But to expose myself in ways like who I believe the God of my understanding is, and what I believe is going on between my higher power and me, one moment at a time, one day at a time, that's, to me, that's intimate. I'd rather, you know, figure out how to deal with farting in front of you than talk about that. And although there was a time in my life when I thought that, you know, toileting activity was true intimacy, or, you know, whatever kinky thing I could get myself up to was intimacy. What I know today is that the act of sex is one of the least intimate things two people can do. It's all the other stuff that makes the real intimacy. And I was scared to death of that. And this person, my current partner, you know, he was like, well, I thought we were still in the getting to know you phase. And my fear, which is that if you get to know me enough, you are surely going to run in the opposite direction, was really kicking in. And I was still at a point where I was using sex to seal the deal. So I thought if I could just get him horizontal and get on it, then we wouldn't have to do any more getting to know you stuff. There wouldn't have to be any more exposure because, you know, you fall into a habit. You go on a date, you come home, you have sex. You have an argument, you want to resolve the argument, you have sex. You know, you need to pay a bill, you got to ask an uncomfortable question like, can you give me money? You have sex. You know, you just, it for me, I did not work on any kind of relating skills once it got physical. That all stopped. And that was all my fear. It wasn't, you know, getting naked that I was afraid of. It was really getting naked that I was afraid of. And so what happened to me in this inventory, and what usually happens to me in most inventories, is that when I put it down in black and white, when I see it, when I own it, when I kind of lasso it down from this big free-floating cloud in and around my head, I can admit to myself, because it's not, I mean, yes, I want to hide it from you, but really, I want to hide it from myself. Mm. I want to hide that I've been living in my relationships without any values whatsoever. That's not something that I want to admit to myself. It's not something that I want to admit to myself, that I'm in relationships because of what I can get. And even though I see that, I can't honestly tell you that I know a different way. But what happens miraculously and magically is that when I admit what I've done, it clears away the dishonesty and the delusion that's blocking me from a power greater than my own. And what comes in is enough clarity for me to see that what's a sane and sound ideal for the future? Well, possibly the opposite of what I've done. Sometimes I have to see what I don't want in my life to understand what it is that I do want. And still, that doesn't just magically empower me to live it out. Lack of power is still my dilemma here because I'm still human. I still want to get my needs met. I still want to have fun all the time. I really don't want to work. I mean, I really don't. Last week was the first week that I was 100% responsible for the bills in my home. I mean, I've barely ever been self-supporting. And now I am supporting the household. And it was nightmarish. I had to pray myself out of bed every day. But a wonderful thing happened. I spoke here last Monday night, and people started calling me. And at first I was like, what the heck did I say that all these people are calling me? This is too much. I've got big business going on here. I cannot be talking on the phone with all these people. I have got real problems. But by the second or third day, I realized God had answered my prayer. This is how God had answered my prayer. This is how God had relieved me of the self-centered fear that I am not up to the task of managing our household bills. By taking my focus off what I could not change and putting the focus on where I could be of service and the things that I could change. And by the end of the week, all the bills had been paid. It wasn't that big of a deal. And things were good. And things are always good. That's all.
Yeah, thanks, Amy.
That's a story.
One thing I want to mention that no more am I to be an arbiter of anybody's relationships or what have you than I would be about what your higher power is. It's none of my business what that is, and it's none of my business your relationships. Now, where it comes into play in your sobriety, then I can hopefully be of some help there. But as far as what you do and how you do it, I don't really care one way or the other. And my ideal as far as, you know, a relationship, I'm still working on putting that together. I hope to be one day able to talk to the individual that I'm close to one-on-one in the moment when stuff happens rather than having to get away from it and then be able to come back and talk about it. If I could do that, that means that this whole thing that we're trying to do has taken root in my brain and that I'm able to process things on when they happen, and I'm able to ask for that that help in what to say in the moment and then follow through with it. That's my ideal. And someday I hope to be there. I'm not there yet. I still want to lash out. I still want to feel hurt. I still want to overreact, all that stuff, which is wasted effort. It's going to be wasted effort every time because it's not constructive. And if I could learn how to be constructive in the moment, then that's my ideal, and I hope to find that someday. And I keep trying. Thanks.
Thank you, Glenn. Thanks, Glenn. Okay, the tyranny of time is upon us, so we're going to let Bill Wilson have the last word here. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are now convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you've already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you've made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. All right, we got several traditions in AA. The seventh is one of them. We're going to pass the baskets. Thank you, Lydia. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any announcements for the good of AA tonight? Anybody? We got something coming up when? June. Come back. We'll tell you about it later.
We should probably start announcing our speaker.
Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members.
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
And newcomers, you're the reason we're here. Is there anybody in the room tonight in their first 30 days? Just so we could get your first name so that we could welcome you, not to embarrass anybody, but just to welcome you. Anybody? Yes, sir.
My name's Eli.
Hey, Eli. Welcome.
Hi, Casey.
Welcome.
Welcome. Anybody else? Feels like there's one more. Okay, conveniently there's literature available over to my right, to your left. If you can fold it, it's free. If you need a book, we sell them at what we pay for them. Just see any home group member, we'll be happy to help you with that. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. And if you have questions about sponsorship, please feel free to come up and talk to me after the meeting. I'll be happy to help. Reminders. Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. There's other people using the facility tonight. We want to spare them to traverse through a cloud of smoke. All of our meetings, the audio is recorded, and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. Could we please thank our wonderful panel again? I'd like to thank everyone who participated tonight. And after we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held in a little boutique Mexican restaurant, a very quaint mom-and-pop place called Plaza del Sol on 22nd and Colony. I'm operating in three dimensions now.
Shrimp tacos. Shrimp tacos, good.
Shrimp tacos are good. Fish tacos also.
Good. Yeah.
You just want to come have some chips and salsa. We'll be there. And may I please have a volunteer to read the last two, technically three, paragraphs on page 164?
My name is Jason. I'm an alcoholic.
Thanks, Jason.
Hey, Jason.
A book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. Great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Shall we circle up? Try to get you out from behind the table. Everybody gets a table back there. Father.